Everybody, JJ Cooper, Carlos Collazo, and this week, Jacob Rudner here on the Baseball America Draft Podcast. We are going to have a lot of fun today because we are going to talk about players that intrigue us. You could call it players we like. You could call it players that we find fascinating. And I think hopefully that you'll find fascinating as well. We're going to do this for a first rounder, for a top 100 pick, and then someone outside the top 100. Each of us will do that. So we're going to kind of get a chance to kind of talk about players at all levels of day. Well, I guess we have to say day one and day two now. It is what it is. Day one that goes day two that goes through the futures game, and don't get me started about that. But Jacob, welcome back to the show. And you've gotten kind of, it's been a, I want to, before we dive in, just kind of ask, like, you've seen a lot of interesting stuff lately, but I would say was last night, as we're recording this on Wednesday, you know, the UCLA streak being on the line, Rochelowski being banged up. How fascinating was that? Or have you seen something even more interesting in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, I mean, historically speaking, that was definitely probably the biggest thing that I've seen. UCLA ending its winning streak at 27 games. I also thought it was interesting from like a player evaluation and talent appreciation standpoint, because for UCLA, this was kind of a must-win game. It was like a huge resume boost. So Andrew Checkets goes out and he throws a bunch of draft prospects in a midweek game. So I know there were a bunch of scouts who were there who were delighted to see guys like Cole Triba go almost three innings, and AJ Crowdell, who I was raving about in Slack. It was really good. He threw three and a third innings. It was a season high. Calvin Prosky, who was making his second appearance of the year and is kind of a fringe top 200, maybe top 150 type prospect, he goes three innings, and that hadn't happened yet this season. It was just his second start from injury. So yeah, I mean, as far as recent interesting things go, that's definitely up there. It was big for the horse race, but also I felt like we got a couple of arms who are going to be interesting in the draft in July.
And we'd probably need to just pick up on JJ's Rochelowski comment, because White Sox fans listening to that might be like freaking out and paranoid right now. So do you want to expand on that, Jacob?
Yeah, he's fine. He went into second base yesterday in the first inning, sliding. And normal double play situation, his right hand, his throwing hand, was up in the air. And so the throw to first caught him in the wrist. He was called out on runner's interference. He was shaking his wrist out. Definitely looked like it hurt. But Rock is a tough guy, and he came back into the game, and he was just fine. It wasn't the best night for him at the plate. But he is fine. He played the rest of the game.
It is funny. I feel like with Rochelowski in particular, the bar for him to clear for people is so high. We've heard this routinely throughout the spring. It's like, oh, Rock's had a bad week. Rock's not really doing great offensively. And you look at the performance and he's just always productive. So it is just kind of crazy to me to think about, like, when you're in that status of prospect, just the level you have to clear to impress people at this point feels absurd. But now we've got a mock draft out this week where myself, Jacob, Jeff, JJ, really everyone on the draft team has been doing a lot of reporting, trying to get a feel for that. So if you guys are listening to this podcast and you missed that, I would definitely encourage you to go check that out, because really a lot of what I've been hearing, a lot of what the team has been hearing, is incorporated into that mock. And as we sit here in the middle of April, Rochelowski is still 1-1, but I'm excited to talk about a lot more players today beyond that.
So, and this is where we kind of, it's also a chance for us to talk about players that we do feel like we do this podcast every week. And so, like, I do feel like we talk about Rochelowski a lot. We talk about Grady Emerson a lot. We talk about Von Lackey a lot. This is a day where we're going to be able to talk about some players who we haven't really talked about on the podcast. There are definitely reports on them at baseballamerica.com and more, but we're kind of mixing it up a little bit this week. And the idea is you could call this, like, again, these are players who intrigue us, and we're going to explain why, what it is about this player that kind of intrigue. You could almost say, like, these are kind of, you know, you could say some of these are Rud Buds, as we like to say, you know, Jacob's guys that kind of stand out to him.
Personal cheese balls once we get further down the board.
Exactly. But we'll explain why. And so we'll just kind of dive straight into it. And Carlos, we'll start off with you. Who is a first round range player who really intrigues you?
Yeah, so I can't talk about Derek Curiel anymore. I've talked about him ad nauseum. People are probably sick of me talking about Derek Curiel. So I wanted to find another player that I really do quite like. And it's a bit odd because this player really hasn't played that much this spring. And that's Tyler Spengler, the shortstop out of California. We've got him ranked right now right in the middle of the first round. And I almost feel like this could potentially be like a Tyler Bell situation at Kentucky. It's a little bit different, but Tyler Bell has kind of moved up boards despite being hurt, because a lot of people around him just haven't really performed maybe to the level that you'd expect. And I think that could maybe be the case with Tyler Spangler, because there are a lot of questions with the hitters in the first round, whether that is from a profile perspective, an athleticism perspective, a conference performance perspective, guys like Justin LeBron slipping down the board a little bit. And I think that, like, the more you look at Tyler Spangler's profile, the more I quite like him in the middle of the first round. I just feel like he's one of the more polished pure hitters in this class. And even if you haven't seen him go out and perform this spring, because he's been a little banged up, the team had some suspension issues earlier in the year that the whole team, I think, had like 5 games where they didn't play. Like, he's been hard to see. We really haven't seen him in an extended capacity since last summer. But I do think that this is a sort of profile that a lot of teams will probably have a lot of comfort with. It's a really advanced swing. It's a lot of contact skills. It's not the most explosive tool set you'll find, but I just feel like with a lot of the uncertainty in the hitters in this class, Tyler Spangler's profile just continues to look more exciting to me day by day. So that's my guy that I want to shed some light on here in the first round.
So Jacob, we just mentioned UCLA, and I know there's a guy that there's several guys that you've been, kind of intrigued by, but who was your first round kind of like, hey, this is a guy you need to be paying attention to?
I think that it has to be Logan Redeman. And I say that because we've always felt, and Carlos and I believe there was a draft pod episode like weeks before the season started, we were talking about how we thought that Logan Redeman had a chance to do really good things. Yeah. So this isn't it's not a newfound fascination. But what I think is interesting about Redeman is that we've really seen everything start to kind of tick up. So in addition to the fact that he does have really good pitchability and there are multiple shapes that are at least average, I think that now we're seeing a guy who has some plus traits that are really starting to kind of shine through. And it starts with the fastball, and the velocity has ticked up. The average game velocity has ticked up, but the high end velocity is really what's caught my attention. He was 98 to 99 in the first inning against USC that I saw. Which, and then he goes crazy. Out. It's crazy. I mean, and this is somebody who I think it was 3 weeks before that start had an average fastball velocity that was below 95 miles per hour. So we've seen over the course of a month a dramatic increase, despite the amount of innings that he's throwing, in how hard he's throwing the baseball. And it also comes with a number of really intriguing secondaries. His changeup to me is plus with fade and tumble. It's got really good separation off of his fastball. He's a good mover. And that's something that UCLA has spent a lot of time trying to continue to hone in. They have cleaned up the way that he pitches. He was a little bit more herky jerky at San Diego. Now it's a smoother operation with less kind of noise to it.
Do you feel like Jacob, I don't know if you've talked about this specifically with them, but do you feel like that is kind of some of the rationale for why the velocity has ticked up? Or do you think it's strength gains? Do you think it's arm speed? Do you think it's some combination of all of those? Because that would make a lot of sense to me if a guy like him has just like maybe just gotten a little bit more streamlined with the delivery and the velocity follows.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a combination of those things. He does have really good arm speed. And so I think that could be a huge component in this, and the fact that it's gotten better over time. And it's part of why his changeup is so effective. Like he does have great arm speed through the changeup.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like it is a cleaner operation. He is getting stronger, and we've seen those things. The one area that I think with him, he hasn't necessarily like really truly broken out is with the spin. The slider's right. Good. It's not a great slider. He throws a cutter that's actually pretty intriguing, that has good shape, and I think that his ability to spin the baseball translates best to that pitch because of the way that it moves, and he does get more of like a gyro profile to his best sliders. So, if you want to nitpick, that's probably it. But broadly speaking, this is somebody who has a really great feel for just the game. He's super competitive. He's around the zone, and we're seeing everything get better over time, which is kind of the trifecta of things that you want out of a potential first-round pitcher.
He is... When you see a guy like that, like I get very intrigued when you see a guy who's kind of, you just see the development, you see the improvement kind of happening in season. That's to me, it's hard to do, but when you see it, it's really fascinating.
I love this profile because like these are the sort of pitchers I find myself really just falling in love with, the command oriented guys who make the stuff jumps. And I do feel like I wonder if his weakness is maybe the weakness that teams feel most equipped to improve at the pro level. Like Jacob was saying, like maybe you don't have that wipeout breaking ball right now with him, but he's shown enough flashes and you have this foundation of command and control, arm speed. You do have a quality secondary in the changeup that Jacob was talking about, that you feel good that he has something. It's not just fastball and nothing else sort of repertoire. But the fact that he's maybe one of the best pure strike throwers in the class on top of all those traits has me really excited. And it just seems unlikely that he's not going to go in the first round at this point.
And I was going to say that one of the things that's super intriguing is like his changeup, which is a really great pitch and has a whiff rate that's kind of been hovering around 40% so far this season, is a 74% strike pitch. Like, he is all over the zone with his best off speed, and his overall strike rate's like nothing dips below 65% right now on any pitch. So he does have a really good feel for being around the zone, and the breaking stuff, I think, is an area where a team can, like you said, probably feel pretty confident that they can make him better. But the foundation of having a good to, you know, maybe slightly above average fastball, maybe even a plus fastball one day, just with the way that it's trending, and then a changeup that I think is presently already kind of there, is super fascinating.
Yeah, who are you thinking about in the first round here, JJ? We got my prep shortstop. Jacob's got a pitchability righty. How about you?
I've got I would say he's a little bit of a pitchability righty, although I think that no one would describe him that way. But Tennessee's Tegan Coons, who I'm going to lay out here, like, if you are just following the draft at a very casual level, you may be like, oh, Tegan Coons must be really struggling. Because a couple of weeks ago, they removed him from the weekend rotation for a week, although he did basically pitch almost like a starter workload in a
Tennessee
relief
role. Tennessee does that a lot. It's odd.
And then he was back, but as you know, for Saturday this past week, as we're recording this. And you would say, okay, so he must have really struggled this year. And I'm not going to tell you that Tegan Coons has been great every time out, but I told you he had a 3.77 ERA with a 54-9 strikeout to walk in 45 and a third innings, you'd be like, 2.37 average against, you'd be like, okay, that sounds pretty good. Mm-hmm. He has given up home runs, and really his one, I would say, biggest flaw this year has been he does love his fastball. He throws his fastball for strikes, but he does not have the fastball to go middle, especially against metal bats.
Right.
And that's given up 6 of the 7 home runs he's given up this year could be described as middle fastballs, which, okay, that's something to improve.
His fastball reminds me a little bit of Jack Leiter's at the same stage, because Tegan Coons does have this like pretty flat vertical approach angle fastball, mid 90s up to 98, 99. It's got above average riding life. And it does just seem like if you're a pitcher who has that sort of fastball and you're locating it middle or down in the zone, that's a pitch that, especially with these college hitters and these college bats and just the offensive environment, you can get touched up pretty good. And I've had this just almost cognitive dissonance watching Tegan Coons, because me and Jacob both saw him earlier this year. He got hit around, I think, 3 home runs. The fastball got hammered, and I came away from that outing loving him. Because like you said, JJ, there was some pitchability to him with how he was landing the secondaries, how he was using a slider, a curveball, and a changeup. I find myself really liking Tegan Coons even still, so I'm glad that you brought him up here.
So that's the thing, though. When I say he's a pitchability right-hander in some ways, like you said, like in pro ball, he's going to get swings and misses at the top of the zone with his fastball. At the same time, he can't miss down. If he misses low, it will get hit. But he's a 68% strike percentage this year in total, which is an extremely – that's an above-average control.
As well, and it's average. Not
– he throws his fastball 71% of the time for strikes. He throws his curveball 67% of the time for strikes. He throws his slider 67% of the time for strikes. I'm going to put up a little pitch plot, thanks to our friends at Synergy. Like, if you look at this, this is a guy who's in the zone right now. Mm-hmm. And I'll just note, Pennsylvania high school kid, which I kind of like. Like, I know he was seen. I know he was all around. It's not something where you're talking about a guy who's like, oh, he pitched 12 innings in high school. And then, you know, no, he was a top prospect in high school and all that. But draft eligible sophomore, there is still, I feel like, a lot to come here. If you look at his legs right now, they're pretty skinny. Like, I think that there's further strength gains that are going to come as he develops. There's further refinements, I think, of the secondaries. I think his changeup can get better. You know, I think that there's a lot here that will happen over the next 3, 4, 5 years. But to kind of go back to what Carlos said, give me a guy that we start with here where he throws strikes, he has feels for multiple breaking balls, and he locates them. Mm-hmm. And then say, okay, he's going to get stronger. He's going to, again, if he just improves that command a little bit, it's that the margin of error there is small. I like their Leiter comp on this. Jack Leiter got his got pummeled at times in pro ball early in his pro career.
And in college.
And in college. And then, but he figures it out, and here he is. Took a little longer maybe than people thought, but you see it now. He's a big league starter. I would say with Tegan Koons, the point I really wanted to make more than anything is the season he's having is better than the season you may be thinking he's having.
Right.
And in a year where there's not a lot of college pitchers who are really like dominating or emerging, I feel like he kind of fits more into that second tier than he does further.
Here's the question I wanted to pitch to you guys, because I feel like both, and maybe this isn't even the case with Tyler Spangler, maybe Jacob's pick with Logan Redmond is the most likely first rounder. I'm curious if you guys had to answer today, if you thought Tegan Koons was actually going to go in the first round, would you say yes or no? Because he's not a guy who we had in the first round of our most recent mock, but I don't think it would shock anyone to see him in the second half of the first round. But I did get some feedback from some teams. It was like, hey, he might be comp range. He might be early second round range. If you had to just guess today, JJ, if you think he's going in the first, would it be yes or no? Top 30 picks, I guess we can say.
I would say either top 30 picks or he's going to go right after that, but get a contract that is commensurate with that, right? Like okay, that's the Jacob. Thing that gets a little tricky is the bonus, because again, you right. are talking draft eligible sophomore here also.
Right.
So I would say he's going to land that kind of bonus. But if you told me that it ended up coming from a team who had a lot of money, a lot of pool space, I wouldn't be shocked by that.
How about you, Jacob?
I mean, I think because you're defining it as top 30, I'll say no. I would lean closer to like the comp rounds or just beyond that in the very early second. One of the things that I would bring up, and I actually like Tegan Koons a lot, and I'll call back to when you and I saw him in Arlington. One of the things that like really impressed me was A, the quality of the stuff, but B, how projectable I think he still is. There's a lot of room to kind of put meat on the bone here and improve everything just with strength. But at the same time, I do think that there's a little bit of trackability to his arm path, which is another issue with the fastball.
Yeah.
I think that teams have been able to get on it so well because he does have some sort of trackable arm path qualities to him. That is a little bit bigger of a fix that needs to happen. And I think that that might scare teams a little bit. And so between needing to improve the command plus probably some mechanical tweaks that need to be made in order to get his fastball to play as well as it probably could, I would see him maybe going a little bit lower than top 30.
What I would say with that is this goes back to the projectability. Those issues, I think, become a lot less concerning if he's a guy who ends up being a guy who sits like 97, 96, 97, 98 right. as a starter, where then you're like, okay, then he could have a few more mistakes actually get by. We see him flash it right now, but if he kind of has those velocity gains that we see a lot of times now in pro ball, if he uses, if his stronger lower half gets stronger and he uses it better, then maybe we get there. But I think that that's a great point you make, Jacob, because it is reminds me that way a little bit of Hunter Green. His has a better movement profile than Hunter Green, but like Hunter Green's delivery was so clean, though, you know, coming up, it was like he would give up 450-foot home runs because it's like they saw it really well.
Right.
So that is our look at first rounders. Now we're going to broaden it. We're going to say top, you can't be first rounder now. Now we're talking top 100 players, and we'll do that right after this quick break.
Kratz, the world has a cord problem, wires everywhere. It's 2026, and it is time to get a
Ridge Wallet 5-in-1. It's not a wallet, it's a charger. Look at this thing. It sticks to your phone. You push the button, it charges your phone while you can charge two different items at the same time. Oh, and don't forget, while it's charging, you got a little lean-to, John. That'll help it sit right there. Appreciate your Ridge Wallet. This is so nice.
Which is great for me. If I'm at the airport and I'm watching a game, I can charge five devices, and then I can just watch something on the phone. Of course, they still have the wallets that are money, too. And we know the code. It's nice and simple. It's FOUL, F-O-U-L. One thing to pack, five ways to power. You can find Ridge's power bank at Best Buy, or our listeners can get 10% off at Ridge.com by using code FOUL at checkout. Head to Ridge.com, use code FOUL, and you're all set. After your purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support FT and tell them we sent you.
So, Jacob, we'll start off with you this time. Looking at a guy who's probably not a first-round pick, but is going to rank, is ranked right now, or we expect when we update we'll rank, because, again, we're making a lot of adjustments to this and players are moving, but a top 100 type prospect who intrigues you. Who is that?
Well, I'll call back to the conversation we just had about whether or not I thought that Tegan Coons was a first round pick. And I think that I would rather take this guy, and that's Ben Blair, the right-handed ace from Liberty. I believe that Blair is one of the most intriguing pitchers in this class. It's a very low, slingy release height right-hander with excellent run on his fastball, which gets up into the bottom end of the upper 90s. We'll be generous and call it upper 90s. He can touch 97 at times, but it's mostly 93 to 95. Again, with that like signature run, he throws a cutter this year that he didn't throw as much last season. That's been really good, especially at the top of the zone. He's got a slider with some very heavy sweep to it that is late with depth. He spins the ball pretty well. And then he does have a two-seam. The fastball, there's really two different kinds of fastballs. He'll throw one that's got a little bit more carry that he can kind of put up in the zone with that run to it. And then another that's more of a true sinker that plays best at the bottom of the zone. From a pure data and metric standpoint, I don't know in this class especially that there's a pitcher not named Jackson Flora who I feel as excited about. I really like
that. High praise.
Yeah, I think that just between the very flat approach on his fastballs and the comfortably plus movement profiles that he achieves in both directions, plus kind of just like where he comes from. Like, I'm a real sucker for the super low slot, practically sidearm. Don't care which side you throw from. Like, if you're going to come from that low and you have his kind of stuff, it's going to be pretty easy for me to fall in love. And I think that Ben Blair's done that for me this year. I'm really excited about him. And I also think just with the ability to spin the baseball plus the different fastball variants, there's kind of still some to be unpacked with Ben Blair. I don't think that this is a finished product. So it's really exciting now stuff. But I think that the ball of clay, to use a Peter Flaherty-ism, is exciting as well.
I love that, Jacob, you have seemingly turned into the command artist pitching fan, because first you take Logan Redman, now you take Ben Blair, who, as we're recording this, through 9 starts and 55.1 innings, has a 2.3% walk rate. He has a 71-5 strikeout to walk ratio so far this year, which is just utterly absurd. I like the fact that all of you guys have taken college arms who can really throw strikes. And in addition to all the unique characteristics of his pitch mix that you were just talking about, like, the strike throwing foundation is pretty excellent. I mean, he's improved his strikes year over year at Liberty. He was mostly a reliever his first year in 2024. Then he transitioned to a full-time starter role a year ago in 2025. This is the best we've seen from him from a pure like walk rate and strikes perspective. And it's kind of an elite territory here. We're already over halfway through the season, so a decent chunk now.
So Jacob, the one thing I would ask, like you said, you love those kind of like the lower slot kind of guy, you know, which again, hey, be unusual. And like his pitch plot, I love how you, if you call up a pitch plot for a guy, you can basically know that player's release point effectively on like right away, because it's like, oh, you can't get to there from any other way. He's really, the thing I always worry about with these guys is, okay, how do you do when you don't have the platoon advantage? That's not been a problem for him at all so far. Like, that has not been an issue in any way, shape, or form. How comfortable are you? How confident are you that this guy's going to be able to keep doing that and start rather than be that, you know, that useful reliever, you know, when they stack, they stack lefties?
No, great question. I think that he is unique because of his ability to move the ball both east and west. This is not a profile that plays to just one side of a platoon. I do think that he's able to move stuff away from left-handers effectively. I think that he's able to move stuff, you know, away from right-handers effectively. And then the profile of his pitches also work well inside. Like, I think that's part of what's been so strong for him this year, is that he's not afraid and controls the ball well enough to work the inner half of the plate against left-handed batters, and has been effective kind of running stuff back into the strike zone just with the way that his fastball moves. I think that that will continue. I will also say, and there are going to be a ton of my scouting friends who are going to clip this and make fun of me, but like, of all the people who I could draft with some reliever risk, I would feel pretty good about Ben Blair. I do think that the velocity has the capacity to continue to tick up. I've talked to a number of people who feel that way as well. I think that, again, I go back to like the movement profiles here. It's a huge sweeping slider. The fastball does a really good job of getting ground balls when he keeps it down in the zone, but he can also miss bats with it. As Carlos said, like, this isn't just purely some guy who's going to be all over the zone and make hitters make decisions and make bad contact. Like, he is missing bats at a super high rate. So if the velocity ticks up and he continues to have the control that he has, this isn't somebody who I hate pitching late in the game for me, because I do think that he'd be really effective in that role. So like the floor for me on Ben Blair is really high and the ceiling is tremendously high. Like if he can continue to be effective to both sides of the plate, as you bring up, I can see him being one of the better pitchers that comes out of this draft class.
So, okay. So that is kind of one of Jacob's huckleberries, because he fits in that, you know, that characteristics that he likes. Carlos is going to go to one of the baseball hotbeds, I believe, of the world. You know, one that, you know, like you just can't, like, you could basically, you're tripping over scouts at every moment, you know, of, because when you go to Vermont, you know, that is a baseball that, no, they, to be honest, they haven't had a big leaguer in quite a while, but maybe this could change that.
Yeah, yesterday was free cone day at Ben and Jerry's, so I got to honor the state of Vermont and go up there and get Caden McCarthy, a right-handed pitcher, who has a chance to be the highest drafted Vermont player we've ever seen. I think it was Owen Killington in 2021 was a fourth rounder on talent. McCarthy belongs inside that range. I feel like second or third round range is a pretty safe spot for him at this point. And I also just want to shed some light on McCarthy, because Brody Bumila has gotten a lot of the attention from Northeast pitchers, and rightfully so. When you see a 6'9" left-hander throwing 101 miles per hour, that makes sense. But Caden McCarthy is going to be 17 years old on draft day. He's been up to 99 in some of his earlier outings. After they've gotten going, he was like 97-99, and he is certainly not 6'9". He's listed at 6'190 pounds. He is this shorter right-hander, but he's also a pretty exceptional athlete. Like the way he moves on the mound, you both mentioned this with Tegan Coons, kind of how we like how he operates on the mound. I think McCarthy is maybe the most dynamic mover of any of the pitchers we've discussed today on the podcast. He's an elite athlete. It looks so easy how he does it, and he's able to generate his velocity with pretty shocking ease for a player of his age in his size. I think you could potentially be looking at like a 65 or better fastball. I think there might be some questions about what is the shape of this pitch. There may be some deception questions with this pitch right now, but certainly it's an elite pure arm talent to build on. It sounds like he's come out and made some improvements with his secondaries as well. He's thrown this knuckle curve in the past that has blended into slider shape, curveball shape, but it's looked more, I'd say, distinctly like a curveball early this year. Low 80s pitch with good spin rates, kind of good finish. And then he's got a changeup as well to round it out. So it is this kind of, I wouldn't say typical, but it is a very solid projection starter right-handed package. And I'm a sucker for high school pitchers. I'm a sucker for pitchers who have deliveries and athleticism that is this clean and easy. I think that if Caden McCarthy wound up getting to campus in college and performing well, he would be a pitcher who makes a ton of sense in the first round with a few years to prove it. He's a Tennessee commit. We'll see if Tomlin takes a shot on him. It's a super deep high school pitching class, but I just feel like if this is an arm that goes in the second round, if he goes in the comp round range, like I wouldn't be surprised. And I think the talent really fits up there. He probably doesn't get mentioned as much with this elite group of high school pitchers. And I'm not sure that he's like definitely in that range for everyone, but I don't know that he's too far off. So I quite like the whole package here.
That's an intriguing one, especially it's a great year for the Northeast. You know, as you said, there's not been really many, you know, it's a small state, by the way. He plays at the Vermont Academy, pitches at the Vermont Academy. You know, we don't have the Texas Academy. Like it's too big. There's too, you know, you don't have the Florida Academy, but you do have the Vermont Academy. Oh, okay. It's the Academy of Vermont. He's an intriguing one. I want to talk about a guy who was draft eligible last year. And I would say that if Trey Phelps at Georgia had had this year last year, he would have gone very, very well. So Phelps currently is leading the SEC in batting average, 393, top five in slugging, number two in on base. His conference stats are, they're not that good, but they're quite good. He's hitting like 355. I did check, by the way. I know that, you know, there's a lot of questions about Georgia's ballpark and all. His road stats are pretty similar to his home stats as well. Statistically, offensively, there is really not a whole lot to complain about in what he's doing this year. You know, he's hit for power. He's doing a little bit of everything. And this kind of comes on the heels of, it's kind of easy to forget, but Phelps is a guy who He hit 353, 441, 699 as a freshman back in 24. Yeah. So
Trey Phelps's path has been super fascinating because he was a very prominent high school player who everyone liked the hit and power. And there have been these kind of lingering positional questions, athleticism questions for him. And then in 2024, like you mentioned, JJ, he really put himself on the map entering the 2025 season when he was eligible. We had him juiced on our draft boards. I think we had him pretty solidly in the top 50 range. People were expecting that, like, he's a no doubt second rounder. And he just kind of chose the wrong time to have a down year. And now he is doing kind of what we expected him to do a year ago. But I'm curious, like, you like him here in this range. The whole industry is going to have real questions about where is he going to play? How much value is he going to give you defensively as a runner? What are your thoughts on, like, where you think he fits? And maybe if some of those questions you're just more excited about, or if you just say, hey, the hit power is good enough for me, I don't care.
He's kind of versatile, to go back to another Georgia player. He's kind of versatile in the Charlie Condon versatility way, which is this. He's played third, he's played first, he's played right, he's played left. He's played, in this case, Condon didn't do this, but he's played second. So he's played almost everywhere, which is really not a great sign in some ways. Like, you don't.
Well, I was going to say, I feel like this is like, it's almost like the anti Von Lackey versatility. It's like, right. Von Lackey plays everywhere because he can, and Trey Phelps plays everywhere to me because he doesn't really have a real defensive home. So,
yeah. But I think that's very true, right? Like, I would say he primarily played outfield first base last year. And if he was great in the outfield, there's no reason they'd have been like, oh, you're back to being a second base, third base. I know they have some outfielders this year, but like, yeah, they're still, I would say the thing I'll say about him though is like, but he's also not like a zero out there either, right? This is not a guy who, when you put him, he every now and then will make a play at second or third where you're like, oh, that was a really good play. And then it'll be like, oh, he didn't make that one. Oh, he didn't make that one. So they're, if you are a team that really believes in your ability to improve defense, I do think that you think that there's at least a chance that you can get him to be a defensive asset, maybe a little strong, but not a liability. How about that, right? Like, if you said, like, okay, if the bat is, if you really believe in the bat, do you think you could get him to be a 45 defender, a slightly below average defender at second, maybe, or at third? His arm's not great, but at the same time, it's not something where when he throws, like, you'll see him like go to the ground at third base, hop up, and he gets it across. It doesn't have carry to it. It often will bounce, but it's also not like, oh, he has no chance of making any plays over there or anything like that. But it really does come down to the reason I'm bringing him up. The reason I think that we will have a lot of interesting discussions about like him being potentially back in the top 100 is in a year where we are saying, who are the college hitters who have track record and production? Mm-hmm. Trey Phelps is absolutely checking those boxes. He has been one of the best hitters in the SEC this year. He's absolutely one of the best SEC hitters who's draft eligible, because a number of those guys who are the best hitter in the SEC, Brendan Lawson, not draft eligible. Mm-hmm. And so I think he's going to be a very difficult evaluation from the standpoint. I do think that the defensive questions kind of are why he's, like, I think his limit is as a top 100 type player. Yep. You're not going to feel good taking this guy in the first round and saying, where is he going to play? Ah, who knows? Maybe he's a first baseman. Maybe. But Jacob, you've seen obviously a lot of him. What are your thoughts?
So I agree with everything that you guys are saying. I think that the step forward is apparent, and it's apparent in terms of the counting stats. It's reasonably apparent when you run through the data. He's hitting the ball harder. He's generally making more contact. Those are all things that I think are really good. There are a couple areas that still give me pause, though. He is an aggressive swinger. He is somebody who likes to go and attack pitches. But for as much as he likes to attack, there is an element of passivity when it comes to hitting really good pitches to hit. He does not attack pitches in the zone at a high enough rate, in my opinion. He does not attack pitches over the heart of play of the plate at a high enough rate. And frankly, even with improvement, the chase rates are a little bit concerning. Overall, it's not so bad. It sits in like the mid-20s, which is a dramatic improvement for him relative to last year. But when he gets to two strikes, he is not a terribly disciplined hitter in terms of unleashing at pitches that are in the zone. He does have a pretty high two-strike chase rate. Those are the tendencies between being a little bit liberal with controlling the zone and also not really aggressively attacking stuff that's in the zone. I do have some concerns. I don't think that the contact percentages are high enough right now for somebody who swings as much as he does to overlook the fact that the heart swing and zone swing are just plain low. Like he's mm-hmm. below average at that, and he's not a terribly disciplined hitter. Do I think that he's done a lot to put himself closer to the top 100? Yes. He's hitting the ball in the air more. As I said earlier, he's hitting the ball harder. I am not so concerned about the defense. Like, I think that you don't want to be drafting too many guys who don't have a position, but like, I think I agree with JJ's sentiment, which is that he might not have a position distinctly, but I don't think that he's a true liability anywhere necessarily. Like, you can feel pretty decent about putting him at second base, but at the same time, is this the offensive profile that I want to get aggressive with still? Mm. Not quite yet, I don't think.
He's never walked more than basically 8.5% of the time throughout his career, which really highlights the kind of aggression, and an aggression in a way that you wouldn't really love. It's 6.2% walk rate, 8.4, 7.5. You're not getting a whole lot of like on-base value outside of what he's doing with his batted balls. But a fun player.
A fun player. And again, this is where... this is what I love about this, right? Is that the reason I'm kind of highlighting him is even in the 100, you are getting a little bit into that area of you have things you like and you things you don't like. Now, after the break, we're going to get into the area of you have things you like and you have clear, real reasons where you say, well, why, if you like this guy, why isn't he going to go in the first, second, or third round? We're going to talk about guys outside the 100 right after this quick break. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you've had to fill your gas tank recently, you're probably feeling financial stress. And that stress affects far more than our bank accounts. It can take a serious toll on mental health and relationships, with 88% of Americans feeling some form of financial stress at the start of 2026. Money worries often bring anxiety, sleep disruption, and even depression, and are one of the leading sources of conflicts among couples. BetterHelp can help. A BetterHelp therapist can help you manage the stress and anxiety that financial issues can cause. It can help you unpack your relationship with money, help you develop coping strategies, and help you feel less isolated. BetterHelp can match you with a therapist that fits your need. A short questionnaire identifies your needs and preferences, and BetterHelp's 12 plus years of experience means they typically get it right the first time. But if you are unhappy about your match, switch to a different therapist at any time with their tailored recommendations. BetterHelp has over 30,000 therapists in the world's largest online therapy platform, and it's served over 6 million people globally. When life feels overwhelming, therapy can help. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com/BaseballAmerica. That's BetterHelp.com/BaseballAmerica. So now we're getting into what I would describe as the really fun area of this, because now let's talk about the guys who... there has to be some reason, whether it's projectability, lack of tools, lack of production, lack of consistency. There's a reason that guys are not in the top 100, that generally when you get to, like when we're writing up these reports for the draft, when you're writing up the top first round guys, Carlos, you know this more than anyone, you've written more of these than any of us, you're trying to tell the whole picture of a player.
Yeah.
And that's the strengths, the weaknesses, all that. When you're writing up a guy in the 250s, you start with why will this guy get drafted? And then you've got to get to the, and here's why he's not higher than this. Now we're into that realm. Carlos,
well,
who is your non-top 100 prospect? Who's
yeah, out? Well, I feel like mine is a good one to start with, because when we initially had this, it was beyond the top 100. And my player is a player who is currently not in the top 100, but I do think he's probably going to be in the top 100 on our next update. So maybe he's at a little bit of a higher tier than the players you guys are going to talk about, because the guy I'm going with is another Trey, also spelled T-R-E, funny enough, Trey Phelps, and Trey Broussard at Houston. And Trey Broussard is a guy who we had on our top 200 entering the year. He was kind of towards the back of that range. And then early on, we were just kind of in wait and see with him. I think he played a handful of games, and then he dealt with a hamstring injury that really kept him out. And since he's been back from that injury, he has been pretty great. I mean, he's hitting 340, 443, 532. He's a left-handed hitting center fielder and potentially one of the better defensive center fielders in this class. I've not talked to really a single scout who doubts his ability to play center field at a very high level. He's a plus runner. He's a really good athlete. And I think there's just a lot of confidence that he's going to stick up the middle and be an impactful defender at the next level, there are going to be more questions on the offensive side of his game, on how the offensive profile just translates to the pro level, because I think there are some contact skills here to build on, but he's also never going to be a guy who's going to have a ton of power. He's a smaller, leaner framed sort of hitter who's going to be reliant on putting the ball in play, using his legs to put pressure on defenses. But so far, this sort of offensive approach has worked for him. I mean, he's never been a double digit sort of home run hitter in college, but he's also generally been a pretty productive hitter in his time at Houston in particular. And so far it's looking like a career offensive season. I think there are some scouts who view him as a top 100 sort of player right now. If he went in the third round, I think that could be really good value for a lot of teams. And I would probably like that profile somewhere in that range. So maybe my pick here is maybe a bridge to your deeper players.
So this is an interesting question I have with that is, when you talk about a player with this kind of profile, how much does the wood bat track record, or, you know, like, how important is, because, like, to me, with some of these players, like, the question then becomes like, okay, not expecting power for this guy, but how does he, when you're watching him with a metal bat, with a bat that performs better than wood, how much different is he going to be in pro ball when he's facing, you know, power pitchers every night? But like, how much of that kind of fits in, like, when you talk about a guy like this, concerns or not, because really power is not going to be his game. So it's like, okay, yeah, it's going to be a lot of singles.
I think it's probably more in that latter camp where you have the wood bat track record. And I think it was 20 games in the Cape Cod League. He hit two doubles in 80 plate appearances. He didn't have a home run. I think it's more a case of like, you're not too worried about it because you didn't even expect him to have a ton of power with a metal bat in his hands. It wasn't one of these players where it's like, oh, maybe fringy or below average sort of power with metal. Is that going to be 30 or even 20 with wood? I think with Trey Broussard, it's probably like 30 or less across the board in terms of power. And teams either are still in on that profile overall because of the secondaries, or I do think Broussard is maybe a profile that some teams just wouldn't be as excited about in this top three round range because of the power questions. But that's really the one clear and obvious issue I have with this profile. Jacob, I'm not sure if you have any other flaws or question marks about his game, or even if you like this kind of package overall.
I like him, and I liked him coming into the season. I do think that maybe there's a little bit of a contact deficit that you'd like to see him make some more contact, especially for somebody who doesn't have a lot of power. One thing that's encouraging is that I don't think he tries to do too much, which is important. Like, a lot of the best contact is already on a line, which is playing the game that he should be playing. He's an aggressive runner. He is a no doubt center fielder. I think he's swinging at the right pitches. Is he hitting those at a super high rate? Maybe not as high as you'd like. I also go back to the thing that I just talked about with Trey Phelps. I think that the two strike chase rate is a little bit concerning, again, for somebody who's a little bit, or not, right, not a little bit, but like very aggressively hit over power. There are guys in this range who I think do a better job at the plate of getting the bat on the ball, but there aren't a lot of players who share his athleticism and run tool, mm-hmm, plus the premium position. So
I do think that
top
that
100, yeah.
Jacob's question there, I think the contact question for me would be more concerning than the wood bat power question because of the profile, because I think Jacob is exactly right. A player like this, you're just not expecting too much power. You would just like to feel a little bit better that the contact skills are going to warrant maybe a chance for like a top of the order type guy, or a guy that's just going to be a real pest to get out. But the contact rate right now, I think, is like 76-78% overall. If it was like north of 80%, that would make me feel,
I feel so much better. Yeah.
Right.
Like, I think that it's just a hair below what you'd want for the profile. Right. But at the same time, like, here's the other thing. Like, he is pretty dialed when it comes to swinging at the right pitches, especially over the heart of the plate. But
right,
even still, like, the zone swing numbers are really low. Yeah, I was kind of nitpicking the Trey Phelps swinging at the right pitches situation. This is a guy who has lower contact rates and a lower zone swing rate too. So, like, you know, there are concerns, but I think that that's kind of the beauty of this part of the conversation. Like, JJ kind of prefaced it, you know, these are the guys who have interesting upside and some tools that are really fun, but like, there are real problems. And I think that Trey Broussard very much fits in that mold. And unlike a lot of guys in this range, and this is working in his favor, I think that he makes a lot of the right decisions. I think that he plays the game really well for like what mold he fits in. And I also think that because of the premium position and the run tool, there is a degree of safety net to a player like Trey Broussard that you might not get in this range with some other guys who are not premium position players, but also come with a, you know, a host of concerns and red flags.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do mine next because I want to clear out for Jacob at the end, because Jacob has a player that is very much a red bud, and we'll let this finish with this. So speaking of players who have flaws, so Cameron Johnson, the Oklahoma left-hander, has been a prominent prospect for a very long time, started his career at LSU, came to Oklahoma. You can see Cameron Johnson on the right week and be like, this is what you're looking for. A couple of weeks ago against Texas, Texas, really good team. Five innings, one hit, no runs, four walks, eight Ks. Really good against Alabama a couple weeks ago. Okay. And then like this past week against Vanderbilt, he got one out. He could not throw a strike. Four runs, four walks. Basically, you're out of there. And you go, okay, well, he had a bad outing. No, well, he also did that against LSU. He also had an outing against Texas A&M like that. Cam Johnson is fascinating because he has real stuff, and then he's also frightening because I'm going to pop up the
terrifying the is a word I would use.
Terrifying. Pitch plot. If you're watching on the YouTube and if on the podcast, I'll describe it, which is the way you would describe his pitch plot is the top third of the zone does not exist other than accidental misses, but it almost is as if like that Cameron Johnson's target is where a left-handed batter stands in the batter's box. It's almost like he needs to shift his target a foot to the right. Mm-hmm. And that's partly, I think, because of his delivery. That's partly because of the inconsistency of repeating the delivery. And so you could be like, okay, so why are you highlighting this dude? And it's like, because if he can, like, if there is significant improvement at these issues, it's real stuff. And we are now talking, he is an arranger. You are talking present physicality. You're talking about a guy who is a 6'6", 255, 260. Let me see. I'll make sure I'm listing. He is listed at 6'6", 256. There's a fastball. There's a slider. Left-handed hitters have six singles against him this year. No doubles, no triples, no homers. Like, that's the kind of stuff we're talking about here. It is real, real massive stuff. No one squares him up, but he does not. He's thrown 56% strike percentage this year. He does not throw anything for strikes enough. This is all going to have to be cleaned up. This is all going to have to be improved. He's probably going to have to. I think there's a little bit, again, I'm not a pitching coach, but when I watch him, he's kind of throwing, it's kind of this, there's a cross bodiness to it, kind of a lower slot, where it's like, you're going to have to smooth it out somewhat because of that, everything, like, he, again, there's sections of the strike zone that just are not targets for him right now.
Yep.
He's always going to be east-west more than north-south, but these are, there are so many things that have to be improved here, but there also are not, he will be available probably in the draft at a point where if you say on pure talent, pure upside, there's just not going to be other pitchers around him who are going to be similar to that.
Yeah, he's a left-handed pitcher who's sitting in the mid-90s, gets up to 98, and has a real swing and miss secondary with the changeup. I think those are the strengths. That if you like him, that's kind of what you're building off of. Like you were mentioning, though, JJ, there are a lot of real questions. I feel like me and Jacob maybe had the best Cameron Johnson look first week of the season, and we were like, okay, has he figured it out? Because the strikes, while still there was a lot to nitpick with the command, he was around the zone a lot more. And for me, I just have real concerns about the spin as well. And this wasn't something that I thought was going to be as much of a question for him coming out of high school as it is, has actually been. But he basically never throws this like sweeping breaking ball that he has. And when he does throw it, it's very hit or miss if it's going to be even around the zone. I think from where he throws the ball and the shape of this pitch, that it could become a useful secondary for him. But as of right now, he has very little trust and very little feel for the pitch. What we're seeing of Cameron Johnson so far this year is the best we've seen from him. He's made nine starts. He's thrown 36 innings. He has never thrown that many innings. His walk rate is right at 17% as we're recording this podcast. That is like not a horrible number for him. It's a very below average number for a college pitcher, but it is the lowest walk rate he's had in college to this point. So like he is trending in the right direction. It's just still a very scary control profile here.
It is something where you almost, the thing that is, again, I want to get Jacob's thoughts on this too, because you know, you've seen him in person, I've not, but the thing that stands out to me is it's almost like with him, you kind of know by midway through the second inning, are you getting good Cameron Johnson, or are you getting okay, get someone up in the bullpen? Like he's had two starts this year of no walks. He has two more of three or less, and he has two of four. He has a 7-walk start. He has a 6-walk start. And again, that 4-walk start was, we got one out. Like there are days where it's just like, okay, well, he does not have it today. He does not yet show the ability. This is not a guy. I misspoke when I said slider. I meant to say change up. But this is a guy who does not have a pitch that he can go like, okay, I'm going to throw this. I'll get this in the zone, which will allow me to get back to the rest of my stuff and get back into my delivery. Jacob, we are talking about juggling with nitroglycerin here. Like it's high risk, high reward. It's very high risk. What do you see from him, and what do you think are the chances that a team could eventually figure it out with it?
You know, this is going to just prove Carlos's statement about him being surprised with me going with some pitchability strike throwing guy earlier in the conversation here and liking these dudes who throw strikes. Cause I am always intrigued by the stuff monsters.
Jacob has changed. He's changed so much.
I love a good stuff monster, and I don't hate Cameron Johnson. I think that there is a real chance that somebody's going to be able to bring him in and get the horse lefty and just figure it out enough that maybe the best way to look at this is if you can make him a starter, you are of genius caliber and you have done some amazing overhaul work to get multiple pitches much closer to the zone, much more consistently than they are right now. More likely though, and I really don't hate this outcome, I think that he has a chance to be a really good left-handed reliever. He has power stuff. The top end velocity is essentially just at 99 right now. I think that if you full-time dedicate to even more strength gains and a track as a reliever, we could see an even better top-end velocity with an average fastball that could probably sit, 96 to 97. And there is a changeup that has plus shape and really good separation from the fastball. Is it a plus pitch consistently? No, but there is nothing consistent about this profile. So I'll take the guy with the upside, especially with the range that it sounds like he's going to go in. The concerns are going to be severely limiting on draft day. But again, I just don't fear the relief outcome here. Like, I think you're making this pick knowing very well that there is an overwhelming chance that he ends up pitching out of a bullpen and that the stuff that comes with would probably play pretty well in that role. I also agree with Carlos. Like, I think that the spin, breaking ball, however you want to describe it, because there really is no feel for spin here, but the breaking ball, I think that there's a capacity to put something together here that's good for him. And right now, I don't know that he has that. The slider that he's throwing with this, very horizontal profile that doesn't spin super well, that he doesn't command at all, there's almost no control on it. It's just not a great pitch for him. Like, I think that it works at times and against college batters because of the overwhelming stuff generally that he has. Do I think that that's the slider that he's going to stick with as a pro? Maybe, but I'd lean towards probably not. I just think that there are enough tools, though, to be really excited. Like, it's a power arm. It's a pretty good athlete for his size. And I think that there is enough in the tank and the fastball and the changeup to have a platform to build off of and maybe wind up with something good.
So I'll use an example of a guy who I'm writing about for something as a minor leaguer right now. So Eric Sarantola, speaking of just believing in stuff, it's weird because he's a right-hander. Johnson's a lefty. But Eric Sarantola threw really hard and was so wild at Mississippi State that I'll never forget that first MLB draft combine. We're watching Eric Sarantola throw. And that's only notable because he was a Mississippi State pitcher. And you're like, wait a second, why isn't he in Omaha with the team? And they were like, we looked at our roster, this right-hander who can flirt with triple digits. There's not really a spot on our roster because we just don't trust his strike throwing enough to pitch him at all. So you go ahead, go to the combine, even while we are going for a title here. That's the level of wildness that he had at that time. But he was a fifth round pick of the Royals. And here we are here, 5 years later, 2026. And he's basically developed a slider that's really effective. And he's become essentially an almost one pitch. He throws a fastball, but too, but he really will just rely on a slider. But he's really good at AAA right now. He hasn't allowed a run this year, 12 strikeouts in like six innings, probably going to make the majors this year. And it goes back to that. Yes. Do some of these guys never pan out? Sure. But when you get to this range, you want to, there's just so much more potential with a guy like this than there is for a guy who you're like, look, there's no stuff here. He throws strikes and there's no potential to get to stuff. That guy's going to be a good org player who gets you through A ball, but then struggles in double A. This is the kind of guy who's much more interesting at that level.
And I would also add, just like, if we're going to play the dart throw game at a certain point in the draft, which is effectively what this is, like, you want to throw the sharpest darts. And I don't necessarily think that that means throwing strikes consistently or comes with a really flawless profile. Like, I would rather take a Cam Johnson, who does have the fastball that he has, who has this changeup that I think could be a really, really good pitch, and just see what happens, than I would with somebody who's maybe a little bit safer and like higher floor. This is because the ceiling here is tremendous. And I'll give another example. This was not my special player that JJ kind of teed up a second ago, but like Cal Randall at UCLA is a really interesting one to me, because I think that Cal Randall kind of also comes with, he doesn't really have a consistent secondary. He doesn't throw enough strikes, but I was at the game, you know, between UCLA and UCSB, like we talked about. And I was overhearing multiple scouts who we saw Cal Randall throw last night talking about the fact that's an 80 fastball. Are there problems? Yes. Does he throw enough strikes? No. And it's very much the game of like, is he going to strike out three before he walks four? But at the range that he's probably going to go in the draft, there aren't a lot of guys that I like more than Cal Randall. Like, I'm going to buy that fastball and hope that I can figure out a couple of secondaries or even one to get him to a point where he can be a contributor, because he's the type of guy who moves rather quickly. And I don't necessarily think that Cam Johnson would be a slow mover in the minors. That's why I bring up Cal Randall. Like, if the reliever track ends up coming to be with the shapes that he has, if they can get him around the zone a little bit more, I don't see why this isn't somebody who could move fast as well. So for all the issues that Cam Johnson has, and there are plenty, I'm actually not as opposed to taking the profile at the right range and price, because I do think that the upside is in an area that isn't comparable to a lot of his same range peers in this year's draft.
Yep.
Okay, so now we've teed you up.
Yeah.
Who is the player that you want to talk about?
I would like to talk about Caden Ferraro, who for the most part is a DH at Texas Tech. But in the words of a scout who is a friend, Caden Ferraro plays hitter. The defense is not a part of the profile here. What does make this are the EVs, which are well above average. He's got a 95-mile-per-hour average. He's got 110 mile per hour to 90th percentile average exit velocity. And the angles are good. If we're going to have a nit to pick, it's that he probably needs to hit the ball in the air more. He has 5 home runs at this point in the season with searing exit velocities. And that is a result of below average angles, especially to the pull side. He probably could stand to pull the ball in the air more. But for somebody who hits the ball as hard as he does, there really aren't a lot of hitters in this draft with as good a contact ability as he has. It is over 80% in the overall contact range, 90% in zone. He doesn't chase a whole lot. And because this has been my theme of the podcast today, that 2-strike chase rate on Caden Ferraro is actually very low. It's just 25%, which is far lower than a lot of the other hitters that we've talked about so far on this show. It's intriguing. If a team is going to take a left-handed hitter who has some room to continue to kind of grow to the frame, he's 6'2", 185, at least that's what he's listed at. He does have really good contact ability. He's got really good feel for the zone, and the strength is plus, if not higher. It's a pretty interesting dart throw. He's a pretty controlled hitter for as powerful as he is.
Yeah, he was one of the names who popped, I know, both for you, Jacob, when you were looking into the data, when I was looking into the data for just an updated power contact chase plotting for college hitters. It does feel like this, like 80% contact and 108 mile per hour 90th percentile EV threshold really gets you this elite tier of power and contact college players of any notable sample. He was one of, I believe, 10 players who at the time had cleared those thresholds. Other names on this list, Chris Hakopian, who's probably going to be a top 10, maybe top 15 sort of pick this year. Landon Hairston, who's been college baseball's best hitter. Ethan Bingaman, really talented freshman with Auburn. Lincoln Garcia, another talented young player, another Texas Tech name. It's a very short list of players who met that contact and impact threshold. And he's definitely a guy that I'm excited that you're highlighting here because, again, this year in particular, it feels like you can have contact or you can have power, but you can't really have both at an elite level.
And he does. He has played some games. I did watch, I think, most everything he caught in right field, which it's a very small sample. He really is more of a DH. I do wonder, I'm a little bit almost concerned that he hasn't really played any first base this year because that would seem like, and Texas Tech has other guys who can play first base. I don't want to make it sound like they don't. They do. But, like, it is kind of surprising to me that we're not seeing him there at all because that would help me be a little bit more comforted by the profile. But as you said, this is, I like how the scout put it to you. This is a guy who, if you're drafting him, you're drafting the bat. But you also probably, again, this is something where you do feel if you're a pro team drafting him that, hey, with a lot of work, we will find somewhere that he can stand sporadically and not kill us defensively, I think would be the hope. Whether that's first base or right field or left field.
And he does have some first base experience too. I think that that's a pretty reasonable thought that that's where he ends up, especially because, like I said, at 6'2", 185 pounds, there is room to kind of still continue to fill out and add some strength. Is he going to be a better athlete when that happens and more capable of having range in the outfield where he doesn't hurt you? Or is he more likely to end up at first base after that happens? I would lean towards the latter.
Interject. His current Texas Tech bio list him at 215.
Okay. Well, even still, I think that this is somebody who's probably a pretty decent candidate to be a first baseman. Just the fact that it's a left-handed bat is nice, and he is extremely capable of first base type contact. Carlos, to your point, and I always like finding like the buckets of guys that exist in a certain category. Mm. It's even rare if you eliminate some of the qualifiers that you had of guys with 50 batted ball events this year. He's as of April 6th, so through 8 weeks of the season, he was one of only 23 players with an average exit velocity higher than 95 miles per hour with 50 batted ball events. So like the bucket is already quite small. Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out, it's with a whole bunch of dudes who are in the first round conversation, like Caden Sorrell, Quinton Coates was another guy for next year's class. Brendan Lawson, who could be, the first overall pick in a world where Dax Whitney doesn't exist. But basically, he is in a really unique bucket. And there aren't a lot of guys who are as disciplined either. Like even if you wanted to, the hit power combo is impressive, but it's even amplified by the fact that there aren't a lot of wasted swings in this profile either. Like he's going to make a lot of contact, but that's not because he's firing at everything. It's because he is actually quite selective and does a really good job of putting the bat on hittable stuff and laying off things that are out of the zone. Like the chase is down. The two strike chase is way above average. And so I don't know. I feel like somebody's going to get a steal outside the top 100 if that's where he's going to stick. Although I have an increasing suspicion that he will not be an outside the top 100 type prospect.
See, this is over. You guys picking these guys who you think are going to end up being top 100 prospect. I stuck with someone who I'm not making an argument.
The Cam prompt was the beyond 100. The top 100, and all our guys are ranked outside of our top 100 right now.
We should talk about Grayson Fitzwater at VMI. You want to talk about somebody with exit velocity and hit power combo? Grayson Fitzwater is a senior first baseman with the athleticism to play left field at the Virginia Military Institute. And there are a lot of teams that like him. It's great angles. It's not a lot of chase. So if you want to pull somebody up, JJ, to finish off the show on a non-riser, non-top 100 potential type, how about the top senior bat potentially in the class out of the esteemed SoCon?
So, well, that is the Baseball America Draft Podcast for this week. An hour of In the Weeds draft talk. We hope you enjoyed. We know that you enjoyed a lot of this, a lot of you who listen or on the or watch on the YouTube channel. So check out everything that we have on the podcast feed and YouTube channel. We keep that pretty stacked with programming, with content every week, but also obviously check out everything over at baseballamerica.com. Jacob and Carlos are very busy right now, providing a whole lot of content to get you ready, to get you through the college season, and also get you ready for this year's draft. And by the way, not just for this year. So we talked about on the podcast last week, for this year's draft, for next year's draft, the year after. Speaking of, if you're listening, if you are listening at the hour mark on this, I promise you that you are going to get value out of going over and checking out the state list that Ben Badler has been hard at work, just that we just rolled out. We have kind of, it ties into both the draft, but also recruiting. We have rated players, basically an insane number of players from every, well, I shouldn't say from every state. There are a couple of states where, sorry, Alaska just doesn't have a guy this year. You know, they had a guy, he reclassified. So they don't have a guy this year who really fits, but we looked at all 50 states, you know, and kind of lined it all up. And there's a lot there to check out at baseballamerica.com. For Carlos, for Jacob, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.